Check. 1, 2, 3.
Is it on?
Yep.
All right. Ready to do that.
Maybe I'll just leave this here and hopefully it'll be fine. Okay. All right. I don't think it's quite long enough for that. No. Well, I'll just leave it. Is it working now?
Yes, sir.
We'll leave it there. And if it ain't broke, we won't fix it. Okay, let's make sure you are in fellowship, rebound if necessary, and let's get back to this. We are to Roman numeral 5 here, restrictions and prerequisites for normal marriage. A, gender, that's kind of important. 1, divine revelation indicates that marriage and even sexual activity must be practiced only between people of the opposite sex. We've seen Leviticus 18:22, Leviticus 20:13. And while one can make the argument that these are under the Mosaic Law, and as such the Mosaic Law has been abrogated for the church age believer, the fact is the moral requirements of the Mosaic Law have never been abrogated at all. And the fact that they are repeated in the New Testament is designed to point out that these rules still govern God's plan. If there is a man who lies with a male, as those who lie with a female, a woman, both of them have committed a detestable act, they shall surely be put to death. Their blood guiltiness is on them. We saw the Romans 1, 23 and 24, and also 1 Corinthians 6, 9. And so the New Testament, roundly, as much as the Old, condemns this aberrant activity. 1 Corinthians 6, 9, or do you not know that the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God? Now this is not a matter, one must distinguish between, say, the concept of inheriting the kingdom, which in many cases was limited, certainly before Paul's time, was limited to just the concept of salvation phase 1, just entering into the kingdom, was spoken of as inheriting the kingdom of heaven. But then Paul has a distinct doctrine of inheritance that governs phase 3 aspects of inheritance for believers. And he's not saying here that these types of people cannot be saved, because that's ludicrous. Do not be deceived, neither fornicators, idolaters, adulterers, nor effeminate, nor homosexuals, nor thieves, nor covetous, nor drunkards, nor revilers, nor swindlers shall inherit the kingdom of God. And such were some of you. So clearly the Corinthian church had incidences of these things in their past. As all churches are going to have people come into the church and they get saved. And they may have a history. Well, they're going to have a history of some sort. And it may contain some stuff that's just offensive. But if they're saved by grace, well then, if God accepts them, our view is that we have to accept them. Now, what we do tell people is that type of activity will not be tolerated in the local church. Should it become known, there will be discipline attached to that type of activity. If one is engaging, say, in an adulterous affair. If they are and we find out about it, you'll be dealt with. I'm just warning you right now that we take these things seriously. And so, or engaging in a homosexual relationship, yeah, it'll be dealt with. And Paul has set the pattern for how to deal with this. Out. You throw them out of the church. And that separation, of course, is designed to wake them up and to make them say, hey, you know, I'm not getting my spiritual nourishment. I've placed whatever this activity is before the plan of God, and so therefore, I've got to change. I say the incestuous Corinthian formed the basic example of this. And in 1 Corinthians 5, what we find out later is that this guy ultimately responded to the divine discipline, to Paul's discipline, and got his act together. Well, point two here, most normal governmental laws flow from biblical principles, which are recognized as being good, moral, and righteous. And 3, any attempt to circumvent the divinely ordained gender requirements are not only opposed by God, but by nature, and very often by the laws of man. Again, until, you know, the world is in the state in which we find it today, where this type of deviant activity is paraded as normal, and we're supposed to accept it, and now they want the same protections under law. We wouldn't protect other criminals under law. We don't put people in prison and then say, well, you know, you've got every legal right as everybody else. No, you don't. If you go to prison and you commit certain felonious acts, you lose rights. You lose the right to vote. You lose the right to bear arms. You lose a bunch of rights in some cases. You may lose the right not to go anywhere without a bracelet on your foot. So the reality is the laws of men circumvent this and stop it or attempt to, just as the laws of God do. Well, B, legal age maturity. One, all people need to possess a certain amount of physical and emotional maturity before they consider entering into marriage. This is reflected in the laws. And again, in many cases, states are now mandating premarital counseling to find out for somebody to sit down and say, you know, you two aren't emotionally mature. You're idiots and you got no business getting married. And, you know, or force them to deal with it and tell them, hey, here's what you need to do. But some things have to change. If you're immature, you don't need to be entering into a mature relationship. So again, this is reflected in the laws, which provide a minimum age at which a person may enter into marriage. A, most states require a minimum age of 18 years. Some raise this to 21 before one is legally able to marry. Well, this is God's way of saying, dummies, I don't want you marrying before this. The human laws reflect at some level God's will in this matter. Because people that are 18, I don't know very many 18s that are mature enough to marry, frankly, nowadays. And what we see, the average person out there, I was driving through, going through the parking lot up there at Kmart the other day, actually yesterday, and some guy comes sailing through there on a bicycle. I mean, he literally has a stop sign. I have the right of way, and he pulls right in front. I should have just plowed him. But he's about 17 or 18, and then he, you know, gives me the I'm number one sign. And I thought something more, you know, thinking I was glad I didn't have a gun because I probably would have used it on him. I wouldn't have, but the point is, you pull in front of a 2,000-pound vehicle on a bicycle and you think you're going to survive that? You're an idiot. And if he can't operate a bicycle any better than that, what do you think his chances are in marriage? He can't even function under the traffic laws properly. Well, obviously people, if they can't have a certain amount of maturity, they really don't need to enter into marriage at all. Well, B, in cases where people attempt to marry prior to that age, parental consent must be obtained by the prospective bride and groom. But if the parents have any sense, they're not going to give it. If they've got any doctrinal sense whatsoever, there's no way I would let a 14, 15, 16-year-old get married. I mean, if it was my choice, if I had any say-so over it. So see, in certain cases that do not meet the legal age requirement, legal sanction must be obtained from a judge before the marriage can be performed. So three, beyond the necessary mental and emotional maturity, each male should possess a certain measure of fiscal stability before he would attempt to take the responsibility for another person. That's one of the fundamental things. Men tend to be somewhat more immature than women, frankly, and particularly through the teenage years. And then even into their 20s. I've seen guys, and you know, they may be 30, but they've got the mentality of like an 18-year-old in some cases. And that's not the kind of person you really want to marry. Because what you'll find out, you know, some woman gets married to this immature guy, and then she'll find out she's not as important as the Kiss concert. Or whoever's popular now, Bieber, I guess, concert. And so, oh, we don't have money for groceries, but we got concert tickets. Well, you don't really want to be married to that kind of guy. And so there has to be some maturity, and there has to be some financial stability. If a man can't provide for himself, what in the world makes him think he can provide for two people? That's just insane. And so I would press people on this. I wouldn't just marry people and say, well, they're in love. And the deal of, you know, they toss around right man like right woman, like they've got the whole divine thing all figured out. And, you know, in many cases, they just flat out don't. And somebody should stand up and say so. But this isn't popular teaching, again, because this is not where our society is headed or where it is even now. And the reality is men that can't take care of themselves have no business getting married. You got no business getting married if you cannot take care of yourself. Because taking care of two is just twice as hard as taking care of one. And so men get married, and everybody, I know in many cases it's not just the women, but in many cases men get married and they got this idea of happily ever after. They're going to get married. Their wife's going to be there to meet their every beck and need. Sex 5 times a day. That's what most 18-year-olds think, anyway, is their needs. And take care of the house, clean, probably work a job, and, you know, it's just going to be wonderful. I'll lay on the sofa and she'll bring me beer. And guess what? That isn't marriage. It hasn't been my marriage. I mean, not that she's never brought me a beer. She has, but but I mean, that's not the norm. I shout out an order. Hey, jump. No, that's not marriage. Well, see, mental status in normal situations, mental competency is a legal requirement for both parties that desire to enter into the state of matrimony. And if you got a 14-year-old and you tell me they want to get married, I don't think they're mentally competent. Because that doesn't show good judgment at all. That shows very poor judgment. And two, this includes normal mental competency, but is also broadened to include competency at the time of marriage. A, if a person was insane when he or she got married, and most of us were, the marriage is not considered valid. You can have it overruled for legal sanity issues. B, if the person was incapacitated, drunk, under the influence of drugs, etc., when he or she participated in the marriage ceremony, the marriage may not be valid. In some states, they would rule against this. If you have impaired capacity, again, from drugs or alcohol, how many people end up drunk in Vegas and get married? I mean, that's been the subject of shows for I don't know how long. It's kind of a standing, running joke. Well, guess what? You go to Vegas, lose all your money, get drunk, and get married. Woo, what a weekend. Well, that's not what marriage is supposed to be about, frankly. D, volitional freedom. One, while the question of willingness is not often the issue for a young couple, most states provide that mutual consent must be present in order to engage in marriage. Two, these laws prohibit couples from being married when one or both of the participants are under duress, which may include physical duress, emotional pressure, or both. So three, some people fall prey to forced marriage through deception, abduction, coercion, fear, and certain inducements. This is also known as a shotgun wedding or marriage. Well, those aren't valid in most states. If you can show that, hey, her dad told me if I didn't marry her, he was going to kill me, then that marriage is not valid. You cannot force people to get married. I mean, not before God, not legally in most cases. So, again, you know, if you steal a woman and force her to marry you, that's not really a valid marriage. That's kidnapping. That in itself is a felony. So he has a prerequisite for a successful marriage. The positive believer must strive to avoid human viewpoint and cosmic pursuits in regard to marriage. One should avoid pursuing a potential mate in ways that are incompatible with sound doctrine. Two, this means that one should not violate the doctrine of separation in order to pursue a relationship with someone outside a Bible class. 1 Corinthians 6, 14, and that should be 2 Corinthians, I believe. I'm almost certain that's 2 Corinthians 6. Yep. 2 Corinthians 6, 14. Now, while this command is broader in force than just marriage, in other words, pardon me, here when he says, do not be bound together with unbelievers, that's not just in marriage. Certainly marriage qualifies as that, as a part of this. But this would also prohibit going into partnership with unbelievers, making arrangements with them that involve you being yoked together with them in some way. That's the idea here. That's what it means to be bound together, is to be yoked together, that you enter into some sort of relationship, whether it's a business arrangement, whatever it is, where you and some unbeliever are equal partners. That would be out prohibited by this. So that doesn't mean you couldn't work for an unbeliever or you couldn't have associations with them. It's not outlawing that. What it's outlawing is getting into close personal relationships with these people, financial, marital, or otherwise. And that, you can work for an unbeliever. You can even have a relationship with them at some level. But you're not to enter into business with them as partners. For what partnership have righteousness and lawlessness? The answer to these rhetorical questions, of course, is nothing or none. For what fellowship has light with darkness? They're mutually exclusive concepts. That's what he's getting at. See, the positive believer is mutually excluded from the negative. Whether people enforce this or apply it or not, doesn't matter that it's not here. It doesn't affect whether it's here or not. So, what harmony has Christ with Belial? That's a term for Satan. I think they're pretty much at odds. And what has a believer in common with an unbeliever? Nothing. There's no spiritual affinity whatsoever. So to enter into a close personal relationship with an unbeliever is forbidden in the Scriptures. And this was taught in the Mosaic Law as well. But you see the principle brought out here in the New Testament indicating that it's still in force. So A, positive believers are not biblically permitted to marry unbelievers. 1 Corinthians 7. Now that one is 1 Corinthians, I know. 7:39. A wife is bound to her husband as long as her husband lives. But if her husband is dead, now that will get you out of marriage. That's one way out, is you can, you know, your mate can die. That's a legitimate way out outside of adultery. But if you're sitting around praying for your mate to die, your marriage is probably in trouble anyway. That's probably not the best approach. But she is free to be married to whom she wishes only in the Lord. It forbids marriage to unbelievers. Paul forbid it in both the epistles to the Corinthians. It was forbidden. 9:5, do we not have the right to take along a believing wife? Only a believing wife. Paul recognized that they were not to marry unbelievers. Even as the rest of the apostles and the brothers of the Lord and Cephas. So Paul was apparently the exception here. He was one of the few unmarried apostles that we know about. And we know certainly Peter was married. That kind of prohibits him from being the Pope, but, you know, we won't go there. He wasn't the first Pope. He was married, for goodness sake. And, of course, that whole evil doctrine of celibacy of the priesthood, that's nonsense anyway. That's a part of the doctrine of demons. We see that in 1 Timothy 4. So likewise, it is unwise to pursue a relationship with a negative believer, which essentially amounts to a violation of the doctrine of separation. And see, this would preclude, quote, missionary dating. I'm going to go out and I'm going to cast me a net, fishing. I'm going to cast me a net. We'll see what comes in. And, maybe there'll be a catch in there. And that's the way we do it. No, that's not the way we do it. That's not the way you're supposed to do it. The odds of missionary dating working, almost zero in the long run. That's been my historical perception of this. I've watched people do it. I've watched people drag people in from outside and they come into class. And in many cases, they'll put up with the doctrine to get the relationship. But that's not what you want. You don't want someone that's just putting up with doctrine. You want someone that likewise embraces it and pursues it. You want someone who makes doctrine their very life. That's what you want. That's why I have such a great affinity with my wife. There isn't anything I can't discuss with her. Even when I'm working on some, you know, relatively complex concept in the Scriptures, I'm able to talk to her about it, which is nice. And she has capacity to understand and in some cases to make a comment that's helpful. Not very often. No, I'm kidding. She does. And the whole point here is pursuing relationships with negative believers is problematic at best. It's problematic. Because you really can't find a verse that justifies it. I mean, I don't see anything in the Scriptures that suggests to me that if somebody's an enemy of doctrine, that they should be your friend. I don't see how that can work. And if they're an enemy of doctrine, they're an enemy of God. But why would anybody want to make friends with enemies of God? That, to me, is a fundamental failure in a big way. Well, 3, from the standpoint of sound doctrine, certain environments and practices are not truly conducive for finding a positive mate. Local bars, gentlemen's clubs, and dance halls. Although the dance hall's not so much a thing anymore. It used to be more when I was young. But now you don't have. But they do have, it's not as though they don't have them. Nightclubs, I guess. You go to a gentleman's club, there's not one gentleman in there. I'm assuming. I don't know why they call them gentlemen's clubs. Frankly, the guys that associate there aren't gentlemen. They're pigs. I don't know. Where do you want to look for a positive believer? In a strip club. Well, I mean, I can at least check out the overt before I, you know, test drive, as it were. No. 3B here, dating clubs, chat rooms, computer dating services. If I understand anything about marriage, it's personal. And I don't think the internet is conducive to developing personal relationships. It's good for, you know, it's good for finding pedophiles and weirdos and freaks. And, you know, it's good for getting them to show up, you know, so they can, Chris, whatever his name is, there can say, hey, what are you doing here? You know, oh, I thought I was coming to have sex with a 14-year-old. Oh, you're arrested. The internet's good for that kind of stuff. But I don't see this as being a long-term solution for people. I mean, while again, there may be exceptions to this. I would say the general rule is that's not how I would look, frankly. Fundamentalist singles minister. I get stuff in the mail, you know, at the house all the time for singles minister. You know, for your church, because you're supposed to have a singles ministry. You're supposed to have, you know, so these people can get together and have their single mingle. And hopefully, you know, they'll find each other, you know, find somebody, and, you know, that's manipulative to me. You know, why would we try to manipulate people into finding each other? Can't God handle all this? And by the way, doesn't the Scripture say what God has joined together? Isn't there a place in this? And see, to my thinking, there's not much of a place in all this for God. These are things people do, they crank up on their own. D, civic organizations, health clubs, and networking environments. That's where I want to look for a positive girls at the gym. I know that this is the big thing today. The social networking and all of that. You got to be on LinkedIn. You got to be on Twitter. You got to be on Facebook. Get yourself out there, you know, advertise so the right person can find you. And I'm not saying, again, people never find their person that way. They can. But the odds are no better than looking for somebody in Bible class, are they? And I don't think so. E, astrology. I'm going to find, I read my horoscope today and find out, my right woman's around the corner. I'm going to meet her today. The stars told me so. Well, if you believe the stars run your life, okay. Alcohol, drugs, magic. I mean, there are people that literally use magic in order to obtain relationships. They'll cast spells. Now, how effective those all are, I have no clue, but the fact is people resort to all kinds of things to get this. And what we would counsel is just the opposite. Don't resort to anything. Be patient, pray about it, and let God provide. Oh, no, that's too easy. Well, it is easy. But it requires patience. And that's the big word of the day, patience. So for many people simply look for the wrong things when considering a potential marriage partner. Looks like I misnumbered here. So what do we got here? 1, 2, 3, 4. That's right. Okay. But these should be ABC there, but that's all right. Women may be prone to search for a husband based on intelligence, looks, chosen profession, financial, or social status. Honey, you want to marry a lawyer or a doctor. That, you know, when I was growing up, that was the big deal. You know, you really, people encourage their kids, marry a professional guy, get you a lawyer or a doctor. And that, find somebody who's smart, find somebody who's a college graduate, find somebody who's financially successful. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't, you know, as a female, if I was a female, I would think I would consider the guy's ability to support me as a factor before I married him. Can he support himself? Can he support me? If the answer is no, don't marry him. You're just asking for trouble down the road. But people often, when they're engaged in all of this, the emotions are running rampant, the hormones are running rampant, and rational thought sometimes just goes out the window. That's why it's good to have someone to bounce this stuff off of. Somebody, and every believer needs at a certain level to have some accountability to someone that you talk to, that you tell things, that you're honest with, that you share things about. I mean, and it doesn't have to be everybody. Obviously, it can't be, really. But you should have somebody you can say, well, you know, I'm thinking about doing this. What's your view of it? And, you know, somebody you trust spiritually that you can count on, and those types of things. And then, you know, and if all of your friends are telling you the same thing, don't do it. For God's sake, don't do it. Your friends are probably right because they've got some distance and some perspective on this that you don't have. So people aren't often, when they want to do things, they're not going to bounce it off of people if they think they're going to hear the wrong answer. You know, it's like that deal, I pray about it and God to do it, and then when he doesn't do it, I find another way to get it done. Well, no, you're not supposed to do that. Well, two, men are prone to focus on the overt package, duh. Men are shallow, superficial idiots most of the time. That's most men, frankly, unfortunately. And not give the issue of inner character the serious consideration that it demands. 1 Peter 3:3-4. And so what are you really looking for in a woman? Somebody that's hot. That's what most young guys think. You know? So that's what they look for. They don't stop and think about what it means, you know, for your what your wife's going to have to do or what she's going to have to deal with on a daily basis once you're married. If your wife doesn't know how to run the washing machine, well, she's probably not that good of a candidate. If she doesn't understand submission, if she doesn't understand certain spiritual principles, you know, and we all have areas, obviously, we have to deal with and grow up in. So nobody's going to be perfect at this. And if you go around looking for a perfect person, you're never going to find one anyway. There really aren't perfect people. But 3:3-4 talks about the observe, their, as he calls it in verse 2, their chaste and respectful behavior. Your adornment must not be merely external. Braiding the hair, wearing gold jewelry, or putting on dresses. When women are going out for the night on the prowl, that's all they worry about. Those are their specifics right there. This is exactly what they're looking at. And he says, no, there's more important stuff than this, putting on dresses. I mean, you've got to put on a dress, obviously. But what he's talking about is the preoccupation with this stuff. Dolling yourself up so you can find a man. Or, for the man, alternately, looking for this in the overt and then ignoring what she's supposed to be. But let it be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable quality of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very valuable, precious in the sight of God. That's the kind of girl God looks for. Well, 3, all positive believers should put doctrinal considerations first. This means that you seek someone that has demonstrated some level of positive volition. I mean, they come to Bible class, they're consistent. You can drag someone in, but again, historically, what I've observed is those relationships don't last. They don't make it because they went about it in the wrong way in the first place. Now, it's not to say, again, there aren't exceptions to that, but many of the people that I know that brought people to Bible class and married them, they're no longer there. And again, they'll only put up with this stuff so long because doctrine is so relentless. I mean, 5 times a week, and hearing things that are challenging and that compete against social ideas of today, and we're at odds with much of the culture doctrinally. I mean, we have to live in this world, obviously, but we're at odds with very much of where culture is and where it's headed and where history's headed, in fact. So, if they haven't demonstrated some consistency in the intake and application of doctrine, and some integrity. If they're not honest, if they're not straightforward, I mean, this is not the type of person you want. And again, my historical experience has been that these marriages don't last. They may do it. They may drag somebody to class. And they may get what they want. But historically, the percentage of them that make it are very, very small. And I don't know, if I went back and reviewed every marriage I know that went that way, I don't know that I've known any of them that are still in class. Or that are serious about God's plan. They may still attend class partially, but some people are, you know, they'll attend occasionally, but they're not that serious about it. I mean, if doctrine is not their life, you don't want them. Because marriage is tough enough without having the truth. But if you have the truth, it can be a whole lot better and a lot easier. And it can be a much more of a blessing. But people that don't make this the issue, well, guess what? So F, one of the most important prerequisites for the positive believer is the virtue of patience. Hebrews 6:15. It's a recognition of the timing of God. We see that this was a fun, and I just cite Abraham here as an example of this. And so, having patiently waited, he obtained the promise. Now, he didn't get the promise fulfilled to him right away. Abraham had to wait through all this, and he was in Canaan. Probably almost 10 years before the promise was fulfilled. Are you willing to wait 10 years to do it right? That's the question. Are you willing to wait 5 years to do it right? Are you willing to wait 5 minutes to do it right? That becomes the question. Well, one, patience comes as a result of applying doctrine to your situation, which should manifest itself in a relaxed mental attitude about your status and your future. Okay, I'm married, I'm relaxed about it. I'm single, I'm relaxed about it. I don't have to get uptight and wrapped around the axle in either situation. And in fact, as he tells them in Corinthians there, relax. Whatever status God found you in, remain in that status. It doesn't mean you can't change it. It just means generally you don't have to. So again, if people aren't applying doctrine to this, if they're tense and uptight, oh my God, I got to have a relationship at all costs. Well, that's what you will get, a relationship with great costs attached to it. That's what you will have. Two, patience recognizes that it is necessary for God to bring a man and woman together. Operation energy of the flesh may result in some serious long-term difficulties. And that's where God brought the woman to the man, Genesis 2:22. God brought them together. He didn't say, "Hey Adam, I've hidden something here in the garden. You go find it." No, he brought her to him. And God has to be in this and has to set this up. And when people are pursuing it, how do you know if God's in it if you're busy pursuing it? You can't. You lose perspective at that level. Three, patience also recognizes that it is God's will for all. It is not God's will for all people to marry. Matthew 19:12. Whatever, again, the situation may be, each one has to consider his situation before the Lord and to say, essentially, okay, whatever God wants is fine. And you have to, like Paul, learn to be content in all circumstances. Well, that's easy to say on the surface, isn't it? I just want you to be content at all times. Am I content at all times? No. I know how hard that is. I understand it's difficult. There are challenges. So don't assume that, one, just because I'm married or have been married for a long time, that I don't appreciate the difficulty of being alone. I do. That's, you know, as Job talked about, what I feared has come upon me. That's obviously one of the fears, that your mate will die or that you'll be left alone. And everybody that's married, I think, to some extent lives with that. But it doesn't mean I don't appreciate the difficulty of that, of being single and being alone, because I wouldn't want to be. But then if God wills it to be so, what am I going to do? Rebel against that and run out and just crank something up? And I always like to tell Linda anyway, you know, I probably would never remarry because you've ruined me on women. Not in a bad sense, though. In a good sense. I mean, I'd always be comparing them to her. I think I would. And that wouldn't be healthy, I don't think. I mean, I'm not to say, you know, I don't know what the will of God would be for me if that ever happened. But I don't like thinking about it either, frankly. Because I understand what loneliness is. And so I get it that people want to be together. I get all that. But the issue is here, it's not necessarily God's will for everybody. Matthew 19:12, for there are eunuchs who were born that way from their mother's womb. And there are eunuchs who were made eunuchs by men. And there are also eunuchs who made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. Now, like, that's what Paul did, essentially. Because it would appear if Paul was a Pharisee that he was married. But we don't know, and we presume that his wife divorced him after his conversion to Christianity, which was a total repudiation of his entire Jewish lifestyle at that time. This is where, you know, of course, in that day and age, when you converted to Christianity, there were major ramifications and repercussions within the life. Whereas today, there might not be. There are some. You're going to, you know, suddenly you're on a new side in the angelic conflict. And so he said, some have made themselves, some people say, okay, you know, I recognize that it's God's will for me to be single, and I'm going to embrace that, and I'm just going to apply in his plan, and if he ever changes his mind, he can. Certainly I would make it a matter of prayer if I wanted a relationship. That would be on my prayer list every day. But then I have to be patient and wait for God to do it, if he does. Well, four, while one is waiting, he or she should recognize that the single lifestyle has some spiritual benefits that can and should be exploited. 1 Corinthians 7, 32 and 34 through 34a. And in fact, the general principle for this matter of marriage and singlehood and all of that is found for us in 1 Corinthians 7:17. Only as the Lord has assigned to each one, as God has called each, in this manner let him conduct his life. Let him live his life. Let him walk this way. And so I direct in all the churches. Was any man called while he was circumcised? He is not to become uncircumcised. Wow, I don't know how you would go about that. But the point is well taken. You don't go change it. Were you called in uncircumcision? He is not to be circumcised. Circumcision is nothing, and uncircumcision is nothing. What matters is keeping the commandments of God. Each man must remain in that condition in which he was called. Were you called while a slave? Don't worry about it. But if you're able to be free, rather do that. For he who is called in the Lord while a slave is the Lord's freedman. Likewise, he who is called while a slave is Christ's slave. Remain in the condition with God, rather, in verse 24, rather. Each one is to remain with God in the condition in which he was called. So wherever you find yourself, essentially, you have to ask yourself, okay, is this God's, what do I perceive to be God's will for me? And only each believer can figure that out. While I can give general guidance, I can't know specifically what exactly the will of God is for every person. I never have pretended to. I know the general principles, but specifics, there's too many variables. And some people are never going to be able to live as a single person. And they've got, you know, a lust grid or whatever, sexual lust, and he says it's better to marry than to burn in that situation. But that's also, likewise, what you need to understand is just as the Mosaic Law was a concession, there are concessions made by Paul as well. If you can't, as John Wayne would say, keep it in your britches, well, then you're better off getting married and under that situation rather than going out and fornicating all the time. That's inappropriate. So marriage, even a marriage that might not be biblically advisable, is better in some cases than the alternative. So again, each person has to sort this out under their own priesthood. There are no hard and fast rules here. I mean, there are some rules. But each individual situation, to me, would have to be considered separately. And each person kind of knows their own self. Well, you'd hope. Well, chapter 7 here, verse 32, but I want you to be free from concern. One who is unmarried is concerned about the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But the one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how he may please his wife, and his interests are divided. The woman who is unmarried and the virgin is concerned about the things of the Lord, that she may be both holy in body and spirit. But one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how she may please her husbands. And he says, I'm not trying to say this to put restraints on you, but to promote what is appropriate and to secure undistracted devotion to the Lord. And then he gets into the fact that there are certain cases where, you know, it's wise to marriage, and then other cases where it's not. So again, believers have to figure this out under their priesthood, but while you're single, obviously you have more time and energy to devote to spiritual matters. Now, whether a person ever does that, looks for ways to apply, seeks to exploit that, that's their own business. But at least the lifestyle has that to commend it. All right, Roman numeral 6 here, the authority structure within marriage. The authority of the husband over the wife in the marriage relationship is part of the royal chain of command, which elevates this relationship beyond the realm of the secular. We recognize there are secular matters that enter into marriage, laws and such, but it's still a spiritual union if it's two believers, two positive believers. 1 Corinthians 11:3, but I want you to understand that Christ is the head of every man. Under the royal chain of command, the authority structure flows down. Always flows down, never flows up. It's like water flowing uphill. It doesn't happen. It flows down. And Christ is the top of it. And the man is he is the head of every man. I.e., when you see a head here, you can read it. He is in authority over every man. Christ is the ultimate authority. And the man is the authority over the woman. And God is the authority over Christ. So the idea here is that this is a royal chain of command here. Now, this elevates us beyond just what society says. That the marital relationship is established by God, and while the partners are separate and equal, that does not change authority structure. So in one sense, the husband and wife are equal, but somebody's got to be in charge. No organization can survive without leadership, and marriage is the same way. And so if you have basically a biblical numbskull that can't be a good leader in a marriage, you're better off without him. I mean, you're far better off without him. So one, the authority of the man over the woman was established at creation by virtue of the order of creation. 1 Timothy 2:13, this is Paul's argument that when God did things, he did them a certain way, and even in a certain order, to make points. Now, whether people ever understand or get these points is a different deal, but that he did. Here, he says, I do not allow a woman, and as we saw here, these infinitives, I do not allow a woman to be a teacher or to be an authority over a man. Period. In the church, we have no women authority. So any organization that has female deacons, female pastors, female whatever, leaders, in any position of leadership in the church, is at odds with the biblical model. And there are entire denominations that are eaten up with this. That they've got women out here. I get these things, again, I get a lot of things in the mail because of the church and all that. And I'll see, you know, the pastors, Don and Vanilla Duncan, or whatever her name is, you know. And they're both called pastors. And I'm like, oh my God, why don't you just print idiot on your forehead? So people will at least recognize what they're dealing with. There are no women authorities in the church. That's God's rules, not mine. I didn't make them. And if I was a woman, I would be thinking, thank God. I don't want a pastor. I don't want to be a deacon. I don't want to have to deal with all that. And it's a recognition on God's part of the weaker vessel principle. That the hard principles in the Christian way of life are supposed to be handled by men. And that God will make capable. So I don't allow a woman to be a teacher or to be an authority over a man, but to remain quiet. For it was Adam who was first created, then Eve. And Paul's argument is the order of creation teaches us about authority. That he created Adam first. By virtue of the fact that he's there first, he was given the authority. And in fact, he was responsible for teaching and enforcing it on his wife. To the authority structure, which existed before the fall, clearly because he says the man was created first, so he's talking pre-fall here, is reiterated and reinforced by God after the fall. I've heard women try to argue that, well, Adam forfeited his authority, and so therefore, and he did forfeit certain authority to Satan, but he didn't forfeit authority over his wife at the fall. Genesis 3:16, he said to the woman, he said, I will greatly multiply your pain in childbirth and pregnancy. In pain you will bring forth children, yet your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. Pretty straightforward. It's not hard to figure out. Even in the English, it's not hard to figure out. That he is the authority. He's the final. In every organization, there has to be the place where the buck stops. In the church, it's the pastor. In the house, it's the parent. It's the parents. But specifically in marriage, it's the husband. Just as in, like, for instance, I was watching, I don't know if any of you saw this, Undercover Boss, if you've seen that show. I was watching it the other night, and the CEO of Checkers, of all things, was on there. And he goes to these restaurants. Well, in some cases, they're populated by idiots. And he's not happy about that because, as he tells them in the show, at the end of it, you know, I believe I have failed you. Not you have failed us. I, as the leader, have failed you because the buck stops here. And he understood that principle. And he said, I'm going to make sure certain things happen. And there was, you know, and of course, you know, obviously this is all somewhat rigged because they pick certain people that they want to, you know, make examples, which is all fine. But one of the things that became evident was he had this one woman in the organization who was, you know, just a basic sandwich maker. You know, put the stuff, the sandwiches together on the board. But she's very, very good, and she had a lot of good ideas, and she was a very sharp person. And he said, you know, he was saying that he sat there and watched her, and he realized we're not using her to the extent of her capabilities. We have really fouled up. But he blamed himself. And that's what the authority has to do. If there's a failure, the buck stops with the authority, not with the one under authority. So this is reiterated here in Genesis 3 within the marriage relationship. The authority of the husband over the wife is parallel to the authority of Christ over the church. Ephesians 5, 23 and 24. So this, once again, by making these kinds of analogies, Paul is elevating this in our thinking, or should be, elevating this in our thinking to the spiritual status that exists between Christ and the church. Ephesians 5, 23 and 24. First, the command, verse 22, husbands, be subject to your own, or wives rather, be subject to your own husbands, as to the Lord. So what level of obedience, women, do you figure you're obligated to render to the Lord? Well, he expects 100%, right? So what level of obedience are you expected to render your husband? The same 100%. That's exactly it. For the husband is the head, authority over the wife. And as Christ is the head or authority over the church. He himself being the Savior of the body. Now this gets into husband's responsibilities when he brings up this matter of saviorhood. What is the husband's phase two job? It is to save his wife. What's she need to be saved from? In some cases, her own STA, her own sin nature, her own stupidity. We all do stupid stuff. One of the things on my prayer list for all of us is that God will protect us from our own stupidity. Because believe me, we are our own worst enemy sometimes. And we can do stupid stuff. We've all done it. And you never feel good about it. I mean, how can you do something really stupid, you embarrass yourself, and then feel good about it? Nobody feels good about it. But the whole point is the husband can help his wife not do that and save her from certain things. But as the church is subject to Christ, so also wives ought to be to their own husbands when they feel like it. Oh, wait a minute. No, at all times, in everything. This isn't, you know, this isn't debatable. This isn't arguable. This passage is plain. So what is the man's expectation? Explicit obedience. I've termed it sudden instantaneous obedience. Why? Because women can obey if they want to. Just as children can obey if they want to. And the question is, will they? And that, of course, boils down to the volition of the person involved. Well, B, the husband is the ranking authority in marriage, but he must first establish his authority in a new environment in which he is the head of his own house. One, while there may be other biblical reasons for the child to leave, so the ministry would certainly qualify, as would say, forced, if he's drafted, there's obviously you got to leave the house at that point, don't you? There's a couple of things I could think of, and there may be others. That's kind of what I'm getting at here is there may be other reasons that would mandate, for instance, if you were a positive believer and your parents were atheists and were, at 18 years old, they wouldn't let you go to church and you couldn't get face-to-face teaching. Well, obviously, you'd want to get out of that environment for spiritual reasons. I could see that would be a valid, I think, reason for leaving. The primary biblical reason, i.e. the only one recorded for leaving the authority of the parents, is to establish a new family unit. That's in Genesis. We've seen that verse. For this reason. What reason? Marriage. A man shall leave his father and mother and shall cling to his wife and they will become one flesh. Also see Luke 15, 11. So again, that's not to say that there's never any other times when it would be appropriate. Here's one in which we see a negative example of leaving the house under the wrong circumstances. And how's it go for him? Well, it blows up in his face. And that's what happens to many people. How many stories have we heard just in our lifetimes of these young single girls going off to college, being on their own, and they're found dead, raped and dead, raped and murdered? How many times has that happened? Parents have sent their kids off. Natalie Holloway, still missing. Only now they got the guy because he, I guess, slipped up and killed somebody else. So how often does this happen? How much danger are these people in some cases, and particularly females, the weaker vessels? How much danger are they in on an ongoing basis that just wouldn't be there if they were at home under parental authority? So people can, they're going to do what they want to do, but here's a good example of somebody who did it wrong. A man had two sons. The younger of them said to his father, Father, give me my share of the inheritance, the estate that falls to me. So he divided his wealth between them. You got to like this kid. He didn't wait for his dad to die and check the will out. He said, I know what's in the will. Give me mine. Well, and not many days later, the younger son gathered everything together and went on a journey into a distant country. And there he squandered his estate with loose living. Now, when he had spent everything, a severe famine occurred in that country, and he began to be impoverished. So he went and he hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, and he sent him into his field to feed pigs. Well, this would have been so offensive to a Jew. I mean, you talk about really God grinding you into dust. That's how this guy would have viewed this. And he does come to his senses. And he would gladly have filled his stomach with the pods that the swine were eating. And no one was giving anything to him. Here's the sad, harsh realities of the world out there, people. Nobody's going to help you. You're on your own. And but when he came to his senses, he said, how many of my father's hired men have more than enough bread, and I am dying here with hunger? I will get up and go to my father and will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. See, he recognizes his whole behavior, his whole lifestyle was wrong now. He repents of this and rejects it. And then, of course, as we know, the son is welcome back. Under the principle here, the story of the prodigal son. So here's a guy who does it wrong, and guess what? It blows up in his face. And he suffers for it and suffers greatly for it. Two, the positive believer should consider the doctrinal opinion of his or her authorities and or close friends. He or she should recognize that the authorities in the life, the pastor, the father, and the mother, are there for a purpose and should not generally be disregarded. That's not to say pastors can't make mistakes or parents can't make mistakes. They can. But the general rule is authorities are there for your protection. So pay attention to them. Listen to them. Three, before or at the time of marriage, the man is responsible to leave the authority of the parents and establish his authority over his wife in a separate residence. A, as long as any child, no matter the age, lives with his parents, he or she remains under the authority of the parents in their home. And that's just a fact. The authority in my home is me. The authority in your home is you. And the authority in my parents' home, it's them. Well, my mom anyway, my dad's dead. But so the point is, if I live with them, I got to go by their rules. They're in charge. So I haven't really established my right to even run a home or to have one. So B, therefore, it is impossible to establish the new husband's authority while he resides within the house of another male authority. So C, he is also to make certain that his wife leaves her family, mentally, physically, and emotionally. And this means there's a certain separation that occurs at marriage, a certain healthy separation. Mom and dad lose the ability, they can offer input, but that's all they can do, is offer advice. Any meddling is not to be tolerated, and so the woman is to be, and women tend to be closer to their families than most men do, frankly. I think that's a pretty much a given. I think history would bear that out. Men are more... Of course, want to go out on their own, want to exercise their own authority. And women tend to be, of course, by nature, generally more submissive, more emotional, and more close, have better relationships in some cases than, say, a man would who wants to go out and be his own man. Women aren't necessarily that way. I mean, not to say that some women aren't, but generally speaking, they're not. So he needs to make it clear to both sets of parents that meddling will not be tolerated. Here are the rules. A man's got to be able to lay down the rules in his household. And he can't do that if he's under somebody else's authority. And so he has to make sure his wife understands this. Here are the rules. We're not going to play the guilt game, because parents are good at that. Parents can lay guilt trips on kids. You never come to see us. You're not here often enough. And there's not anything wrong with maintaining an open civil relationship as long as there is no meddling. As long as there is no attempt to try to control you, then okay, that's fine. We can have a relationship and be cordial and happy and all of that. But if you start meddling, you start talking to my wife behind my back and filling her head full of crap, you and I are going to go at it. In fact, we won't go at it because I'll make sure you don't see her anymore. I will not have that. And so you've got a part of it is you're there to protect your wife from nonsense like that. So, okay, well, our time is gone, so we're ready to, we'll stop there today. It's noon. And continue on here with this on Tuesday. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to consider these things. May God the Holy Spirit enlighten us in Christ's name. Amen.